Today we're going to talk about Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah were originally one book in both the Hebrew and the Septuagint. It was sometime in the Middle Ages that the books started becoming separated. But in the Septuagint, Ezra and Nehemiah is actually listed as second Esdras, which Esdras is the Greek form of Ezra. So if we were to put it in more common English, we would say second Ezra. First Ezra in the Septuagint is a book that covers a lot of the same ground as Ezra and Nehemiah, but it actually covers some of the same ground as the end of Chronicles. So it's sort of a parallel account. There's a lot of similarities. And then but if you look in the King James Apocrypha, if you have an edition that has that, first Esdras is the same as the Septuagint, but second Esdras in the King James Apocrypha would actually be third Ezra or Esdras in the Septuagint. And that book is actually not considered to be part of the deuterocanonical books by the church, but it's sort of an appendix to the Bible. In other words, it's a book that the church has preserved, but it's never been held out to be really on the same level as either the deuterocanonical books or the canonical books. And in the Latin Vulgate, those two books were preserved consistently, which is why you find it in the King James deuterocanonical books. But in the Orthodox Study Bible, you don't find a third Ezra. You just find first and second Esdras. And also, one other quirk of the Orthodox Study Bible is that even though Ezra and Nehemiah are one book in the Septuagint, they have second Esdras, or Ezra, which is the same as the canonical Ezra book, but then they have Nehemiah as a separate book, which really, if they're going to follow the Septuagint naming, they should have just said second Esdras or Ezra and left it at that, because they really are one book, even though the reason why the books got separated is you do have narrative in the first person from both Ezra and Nehemiah. But the thing is both books have narration, first-person narration, and Nehemiah has narration from both Nehemiah and Ezra. And I always thought that was strange when I was reading through Nehemiah. You just read Ezra, and then you get into Nehemiah, and then all of a sudden Ezra pops up again, and he's talking in the first person. But it makes sense if you think of this as really one book that's just been sort of arbitrarily separated out. Origen was the first person who started talking about these as separate books, but in most canonical lists, they're just listed as one book. Now, there's different ways that you could outline we're going to talk about them as one book, although I'll make reference to Ezra and Nehemiah as I talk about it. But one way to look at the structure of the book of Ezra is in terms of sort of the broad who's talking. In other words, because a lot of it is first-person narration. So the first six chapters of Ezra is sort of an historical review, and it's not first-person narration. But then chapter 7 through 10 is the first part of Ezra's memoirs. And then Nehemiah 1 through 7 is Nehemiah's memoirs, part one. Then Nehemiah 8 through 10 is the second part of Ezra's memoirs. And then Nehemiah 11 through 13 is part two of Nehemiah's narration. Now, obviously, when you have first-person narration, you have to assume that the source of that had to come from the person who was doing the narration. So historically, people have usually said that Ezra is the one that wrote the book, although Nehemiah wrote the parts of Nehemiah that actually have him talking. It's quite likely that these memoir sections were actually reports back to the Persian king, because the whole historical setting of Ezra and Nehemiah is that after the Babylonians were taken over by the Persians, the Persians were a much more tolerant people. And one of the ways that they built up the strength of their empire and they built up loyalty among the peoples that they had conquered, is that they allowed all these people that the Assyrians and the Babylonians had deported to return back to their homelands, and the Israelites were among the beneficiaries of this. And so Ezra begins with a decree from Cyrus saying, you can go back to your land and you can rebuild your temple. But of course, the whole book is all about the struggles that followed after that, because it wasn't just, okay, they went back and they built the temple and everything, everybody was happy ever after. When they went there, they had opposition. There were people in the land, especially the Samaritans, that at first said, hey, we want to help. But they were told, look, we don't want you to help us because you're really not part of our people. And so they became opposed to what the Ezra and Nehemiah were trying to do, and actually talked a later Persian king into putting a stop to the building of the temple. And so things were delayed for quite some time until they got another king to agree to go ahead and do the rebuilding. So another way of looking at the flow of these books would be to talk about chapter 1 through 2 being the return of the first group of exiles, and chapter 3 through 6 is the restoration of the worship of God in the temple. And then Ezra chapter 7 through 10 is the second return under Ezra. And then Nehemiah 1 through 7 is the restoration of the city walls, because that's the first thing that Nehemiah did, was to build the walls. And then chapters 8 through 13, you have the reforms of both Ezra and Nehemiah. Because the problems that they were running into was that people were... There was a lot of disorder that had come into to reign among the people, and also some people were taking advantage of their fellow countrymen and taking their land, lending them money on usury, and so Nehemiah forced these people to put a stop to this. And so the basic theme of this whole book is, this is sort of the reversal of the exile. I mean, it's not just the return, but it's the beginning of the healing of all the damage that was done as a result of the exile. But even though they had Zerubbabel as a leader who was a descendant of David, one thing that you see that's changed in Ezra and Nehemiah is that the unifying principle of the Jews was no longer the monarchy, because they didn't have a monarchy, even though they had people who were descendants of the monarchy. But the unifying principle was the law and also the temple, the worship. And also, one other thing about Ezra himself is that Ezra is called a scribe. And so Ezra really begins the rise of the influence of people who were experts in the law. You really didn't have that much influence from those kinds of people during the monarchy, but in after the return of the people to the land, they became very important. And essentially, you had the priest, the scribes, and the Pharisees were the main people who were the leaders of the Jews, and it was probably in that order of importance as far as how much influence that they had. Any questions about Ezra and Nehemiah before we move on to Esther? I mean, there's more that we could say. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's setting the groundwork for the New Testament. But the other piece of this, of the groundwork for the New Testament, to really understand it, is the books of Maccabees, and those which we'll talk about later on.
Because it says a lot in the New Testament. Could you explain the difference between the scribe and the Pharisee?
Well, the Pharisees were sort of a sect. There were three main sects of Judaism at the time of the New Testament. There were Pharisees, Sadducees, and there were Essenes. But the Essenes you actually don't hear mentioned in the New Testament, because they were off living out in the Dead Sea as a sort of kind of monastic community that was set apart from everybody else. But the Pharisees are basically the spiritual descendants of the Maccabees. They were zealots for the law. They were resisting Hellenization and attempts to force pagan customs upon the people. In the book of Maccabees, they use this term in reference to these people. They were called the Hasidim, which basically means the faithful of the covenant. They were the ones that were keeping the covenant. And so the Pharisees were sort of the religious expression of that whole movement of people who were standing firm for the law. And they were the popular religious leaders that you would have encountered on the synagogue level. Whereas the Sadducees were primarily related with the priests in the temple, although some of the priests were Pharisees as well. I mean, they weren't all Sadducees, but the Sadducees were the ones that rejected the resurrection. They rejected any book other than the law of Moses, and they didn't believe that there were demons or angels, you know, and so they were sort of an odd... They certainly were not what the majority of the people ascribed to, but they're mentioned, you know, in the Gospels in a couple of places. But the Pharisees were the primary group, and even though in the Gospels the Pharisees are always talked about as a separate group from Christ, there are some of the Pharisees that are talked about in more positive terms, like Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. And if you were trying to see where would Christ fit into the picture, to most people would have probably said, well, Christ would have fit in with the Pharisees, but when you say that to people who are used to hearing what the Gospels have to say, most people would say, you know, anathema, anathema, because how could Christ be part of the Pharisees? But if you read what the Pharisees had to say about each other, they often were critical of each other, too. I mean, there were Pharisees that would criticize the hypocrisy of other Pharisees. And so Christ was certainly in the same religious tradition, but He criticized their excesses, but also even Christ made some positive statements about the Pharisees. For example, in one place he said, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll no wise enter the kingdom of heaven. And a lot of times people try to dismiss that by saying, well, he means that the righteousness by faith as opposed to the actual righteousness, but I'm not so sure that that's what Christ actually meant. Because what he was saying was, is, you know, these people are trying to live a righteous life, but you need to do better than that. So he certainly was not saying that you could get by with doing less than they did. Any other questions or comments? Okay. One thing about the time frame of Ezra and Nehemiah I should have pointed out is that we're talking about sometime around 480 B.C. to about 440 B.C., and then Nehemiah would have gotten his commission to go to the Holy Land to restore the walls sometime around 445 B.C. And if you remember the story, he was a cupbearer to the king, and the king noticed that he was of sad countenance one day because he had gotten news about how destitute Jerusalem was and the sorry state that the people were in. And when he told the king about it, the king, you know, authorized him to go and to rebuild. So you never hear the Jews speaking negatively of the Persians. You know, in Western history, when you look at things from the Greek perspective, the Persians are always painted as the bad guys of history, and they certainly were not, you know, Mahatma Gandhi types. I mean, the Persians certainly had a brutal side to them, but compared with everything that the Israelites had to deal with up to that point, the Persians were pretty good. And there's not, as far as I'm aware, there's no talk ever of we should revolt against the Persians or anything like that. I think that the Israelites saw the Persians as having taken over, being a providential thing. And not only did they allow the Jews to rebuild the temple, but the king, even out of his own treasury, funded the construction and also funded the daily sacrifices that were done in the temple. So, and the Persians also were, you could say they were monotheistic. I mean, in some ways they were dualist because they believed that there was a good God and then there was like the devil. So in some ways you could say they certainly had more of the truth than most of the pagans did. And so that might explain to some extent why they were as kindly disposed to the Jews as they were. Well, and then there's the book of Esther. The book of Esther actually chronologically is a little bit prior to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Xerxes, although there might have been some overlap, I'm not exactly sure what the how the people would fit this in chronologically, but Xerxes is usually considered to be the king that's talked about there, who I believe the Hebrew name is Ahasuerus, but Xerxes the first. And he lived from 519 to about 465, or maybe that was his actual reign. I'm not sure. I'd have to double check that. But there are a lot of critical scholars that would say, well, we know from Herodotus, who was a Greek historian, the name of Xerxes' wife, and it wasn't Vashti, who's the queen that's talked about in the book before Esther. And also the kings of Persia married from like seven noble families that they would marry into, and Esther obviously wasn't a member of that. And so there are a lot of critical scholars that say, well, the book of Esther is just pious fiction. However, there's a lot of other things that are said about the kings of Persia, and they typically had more than one wife. There's some records that indicate that Xerxes had three wives, and so if we know the names of two and they don't happen to be the one that Herodotus mentioned, that only means that we're talking about two of the other three. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the history there. Esther had a Hebrew name, Hadassah, but she also had a Babylonian Persian name, because a lot of the Jews who were living there were forced even to take Babylonian names. This was true of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and also Daniel, whose Babylonian name was, I think, Belshazzar. The story is sort of, it's written almost like a novel. It's very easy to read. It's not difficult to understand. It begins with the king who's having a party, and he's probably bragging on how beautiful his queen Vashti is, and he basically fetches his wife, and she's irritated and says, you know, I'm not going to come just because you fetched me to come. And so she refused, and so Xerxes decided, well, look, I'm done with you then, you know, if you're not going to do what I tell you to do. And so he goes looking for another queen, and he winds up with Esther. But there's this other plot line of the conflict between Mordecai and Haman, who Mordecai had done the king a favor, discovered a plot against him, and hadn't been properly rewarded. And then Haman was offended because Mordecai didn't bow in his presence, and so he was wanting to get even with Mordecai. Then one day the king is asking, because he's having trouble sleeping, so he's having people read the records of the king, and there's this mention that Mordecai had done the king this favor, and he said, was he ever rewarded? No, he wasn't. And so Haman goes to the king, and he starts talking about himself, he thinks, about, you know, because the king is asking, how should I reward someone who's done the king a favor? And Haman's talking about, well, I would have you do this, that, and the other thing. And he's expecting to have all that bestowed upon himself. And much to his chagrin, it winds up being him that has to do all these honors for Mordecai, his enemy. So then he tricks the king into issuing a decree that basically the Jews are going to be wiped out on a particular day. So Mordecai talks to Esther and says, look, you know, don't think that just because you're the queen, you're going to escape from this. You need to say something. You need to stand up. And so there's a story of Esther going into the king's presence when, by Persian custom, unless she was summoned, she had no right to do it. And it was basically up to the king when she did that to decide whether she lived or died, because she wasn't supposed to do that. And so fortunately for her, he didn't have her killed. And then she was able to ask him to to meet with her to talk about what it was that she wanted. She didn't really spell out what she wanted at that point. And then there's you have Haman, who she points out to Haman, look, I'm a Jew, and you're trying to kill my people. And Haman gets all upset and is basically, you know, pleading with her, you know, and when the king comes into the room, it looks very much like he's attacking her. So then the king decides to have Haman killed. Haman's actually hung on the gallows that he had constructed for Mordecai. So it's very much along the lines of what you find in the Psalms, where it talks about people falling into the snare which they have set for others. You know, that's exactly what happened to him. And so because Persian law didn't allow the king to reverse his own decree, he then issued a second decree and said that the Jews had the right to defend themselves. And so the Jews, rather than being slaughtered, were able to slaughter their enemies in self-defense. And so this became an annual feast day, the Feast of Purim, which the Jews keep to this day. And so one of the things about this book that's kind of interesting, as far if you're talking about just from a canonical perspective, is in a lot of the list of the books of the Old Testament that you find among the fathers, Esther is not listed. If they're giving you the shorter list, which is the Hebrew list, they actually usually will include Baruch, but they won't include Esther. But eventually, Esther was included in the Hebrew canon because they had this feast that they were observing, and this was the book that explained what the feast was all about. So the Jews eventually went ahead and included it in the canon. Of course, because we have a canon that is broader than the Hebrew canon anyway, we included it, but it technically would be a Judeo-canonical book from our perspective, even though from the Jews' perspective it would be a canonical book. So any questions or comments about Esther before we move on? Well, I'll just sort of give you an idea of where we're headed next. If we were going chronologically through historical books, we would then next time talk about the books of Maccabees. But what I'm going to do, because they're covered in a book that's different than the one that I'm using for the class, of course not all of you probably are reading it, but that book follows the books that are in the Protestant canon. So we'll come back to the book of Maccabees after we finish talking about the prophets, but or actually the wisdom books and then the prophets. So next time we'll talk about Job and maybe talk about the Psalms. The Psalms are a pretty big topic, so I might just talk about them on a lecture off by themselves, because there's a lot that can be said.